Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Hard Yards Rugby League podcast. We are your voice, we are your supporter, we are your advocate. Wherever you are in the rugby league world, if you are doing the hard yards, I'm your regular host, Lee Addison. You can contact me at admin@rugbyleaguecoach.com.au, Twitter at RLCoach on the net, Facebook or Instagram is at Rugby League Coach. This podcast is born out of the website rugbyleaguecoach.com.au. If you are a strength and conditioner, a player, a coach or an administrator, I suggest you get a membership for that for $7 a month minimum. Especially long interview with Philip Kaplan here, our normal UK correspondent, and I'm actually sat in the studio with him in Leeds. Enjoy. Episode 13B of the Hard Yards Rugby League podcast. Normally delivering this from my house in Brisbane, but I am sat next to our usual UK correspondent, Phil Kaplan, in his illustrious surroundings, salubrious surroundings in Leeds. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. You mean makeshift studio?
There's nothing makeshift about it. This is a great little resource. I mean, just to my right, I've got a European Federation banner. What do you use that for?
Well, it was a backdrop for a press conference, so okay. We thought we'd salvage it.
Okay. So you don't hold those press conferences in here, is what
you could
saying.
Do. We could do.
Behind me, and you'll see this on the social media, I've got every edition of 40-20, I think, ever done. How many has there been?
The next one will be 100.
Wow.
So a bit of a landmark.
In front of me, we've got a little bit of a Great Britain shrine, I suppose, but also Adrian Morley is prominent in that, and then there's a Leeds Rhino's mug underneath, Stones Bitter, which I haven't seen for a long time, and a Catalan Dragons cap and a Kiwi fern. You know, everywhere I look in this place, mate, there's something else I find.
Well, yeah, excuse me, you haven't even seen upstairs yet, where the real shrine to heritage is.
Well, I'll definitely have a look at that and maybe get that on video too. But to business.
Yes.
I'll get you to ask me something first, if that's all right. Well, three questions.
We're sat in front of a Sabutio Rugby League pitch with all the players as if it was a coaching session.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting for you to outline where we've got them in the wrong position.
That's right, that's right.
But I'm intrigued why you're over here. I mean, great to see you, obviously, and catch up
too.
In person. But I know you've been on a mission, and a bit of a historic mission. Been over to Poland to play the first domestic international there, which is important in its own right. But I'm intrigued about the role of the coach, where probably half, if not two-thirds of your squad is domestic players who are at the beginning of their journey.
Yeah,
probably don't understand all the nuances of the game, love the physical contact side, and you brought with you seven or eight heritage players who are obviously a little bit more advanced. As a coach, how do you meld that into a team?
It's not easy at all, and I think I always imagine an NRL or Super League coach trying to do this. He would have to really strip back what they do. The best mentor I got in this regard was Matthew Elliott when I was his assistant coach with the USA in 2011 for the qualifiers. I went there as an assistant coach trying to impress him a little bit with whatever. He was virtually horizontal. He was that laid back. And they qualified for the World Cup at a canter. And this was very different to how he was at Penrith, when I worked with him at Penrith. And I think he, from memory, he'd been sacked a few months earlier and ended up as an assistant coach to Brian Smith. Matt was one of those coaches that really thought about the game 24/7, or at least while he was at work, and some would accuse him of being a little bit hard to understand sometimes. But for the USA Tomahawks, he was a complete opposite. Now, I don't know if that was a conscious decision. I don't know if he was just drained by the whole rugby league experience, that he just wanted a little bit of a break from it all. Just like a teacher doing his last lesson on period four on a Friday, just goes through the motions a little bit. But it didn't half work. Being the reflective kind of coach I am, I reflected on that And I think I come to the conclusion a few months later, I thought, that is the key. I think the key for anybody who comes from Australia or England who's played some high-level football, and don't get me wrong, the Aussie boys that went over, you know, one was a third-grade player in Wollongong, one was 40 and had played no games all year. His last game was in the Emerging Nations last year. Another one had been travelling around the world, not played all year. You know, it's not like I brought over Darren Lockyer and Jonathan Thurston and Billy Slater.
But comparatively speaking,
yeah,
you needed that experience.
Mm. And what I've come to realise, and I saw this also on the USA Tomahawks World Cup trip in 2013, you're quite often dealing with players who have been trained really hard throughout the year. Not only that, they've been under some scrutiny from fans and media, etc., etc., etc. You do have to ease back a little bit on them.
Mm.
Because in some cases, they're also making great sacrifices. So the USA Tomahawks didn't get paid. I know myself, when I was on that trip, I lost pay from work because we stayed longer than we should have done. I went back to bills that were in red because I couldn't deal with them at the time. Pardon me. On this trip, the players had all paid between $2,000 and $3,000. So, first of all, to answer you, the first part of the answer to your question is, I had to respect those Aussie players. Needed to have downtime, and also train because they wanted to achieve something, but have downtime too. Secondly, I anointed them all as assistant coaches because I didn't have an assistant coach.
Right.
So I gave them some ownership of the whole process. That meant that when we were dealing with domestic players, so the basic makeup of the team was 10 domestic and 7 heritage. Now, 3 of those heritage players actually have Polish passports because they were either born in Poland or whatever. And one of them is fluent in Polish. There was 2 players who could translate on the field, so I put them in pivotal roles. Also, what that allows me to do, if I have a domestic player who runs in training and tries to play the ball and he does it in a way that you and I couldn't fathom beforehand, my coaching football autism is too far down the pantheon sometimes. So a player who's right next to him will say, no, mate, you just need to put your foot. Because a couple of the player balls early in the week, they were hooking the ball back. It was going about 20 metres behind him. You know.
There's a quick play the ball and a quick play the ball.
And they were dealing with that there and then. Thirdly, as well, part of the third answer to the question, have I already done third, I can't remember, was that I literally got the props and said, instead of running like that, you need to run like this. And that way, and just subtle little things like that. And what I did find was that even though they'd not played rugby league, some of them were real quick learners because they were the best in their group, in their peer group. So that's how we did it, basically.
Because you didn't have a lot of time either.
No.
So you couldn't institute too many systems.
No.
You know, you can perhaps they can understand territory.
Yeah.
But when you've only got a limited amount of time, is it as much about bonding as tactics? Does that have to be a key part of it?
I'll mention the tactics before I mention the bonding. I've won a school competition as a coach this year. I didn't have a halfback or a 5-8 or a standoff. I've been in Australia too long.
You have. If you're over here, it's standoff.
A standoff or a scrum half. I didn't have a standoff or a scrum half. So my fullback played as the pivot. Right? So I played with 2 extra props.
Right.
Now, if you look at the team sheet that is given out in England that you have to fill out, the game tries to designate that you need 1 fullback, 2 wings, 2 centres, a standoff, a scrum half, so on and so forth. Well, Poland last week, they had a fullback who played a traditional fullback role. They had wings and centres who played traditional fullback roles, centre and wing roles. I had a half. I didn't have a standoff. I had an extra prop. And my second role was a complete roaming commission around the field. So completely changed.
Yep.
I said to the boys, I said, forget any kind of tactical things that you've ever had before. We're going to do this completely different. And my half was told, the minute we were going forward, to push the ball a bit wider. That was it. That was the game plan. So there's the big tactical. Now, the bonding, yes, I took them all out for a drink on the Monday. Went to a pub that said alcohol behind, and yes, it was a alcohol, and we filled it. And and the boys were free. If they wanted a drink Tuesday or Wednesday after training, they could. You know, there was no... But I cut that off after Wednesday, and yeah. And I also had a rule that... I have a rule around Poland that if any of them scratch the genitalia, they have to do 10 push-ups.
Right.
You'd be amazed how many people...
Does that go on a lot in Poland?
Of course it does. It goes on around all mankind. Trust me, the coach isn't immune to doing it, apparently, too. I had to do 10 push-ups at one point. And because men do that, and you'd be amazed at how funny it creates, a funniness situation it creates. If people look back at the live stream of the game, at half time, I was doing a serious team talk, and Johnny, the Polish fella, put his hands down there, so he had to do 10, and everyone asked me on the live stream, why is he doing 10?
Yeah.
You know, that wouldn't happen in the NRL Grand Final or in round 24, but it happens on these kind of
and
trips.
That's, I guess, where you've got to be adaptable as a coach. Mm-hmm. You've got to realise not how necessarily you'd like to play,
yeah,
but the resource you've got,
just to get the
how
job
you
done.
Need to play.
And one thing I've noticed with all my Polish sides, and because we're 6-6 now since I took over, we always start well.
Mm.
At half time, the least amount of points we've been up in a game is 14. We won the Emerging Nations World Trophy final 14-12. We were up 14-0 at half time, and we just managed to cling on. So,
in terms of potential for Poland,
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, Landmarks play first game. I'm not going to try and pronounce where it was played. To me, it's Lodz, but you're going to tell me it's
Łódź.
There you go. Where do Poland go from here? Because the story of development rugby league at international level is not that much different to domestic level in some respects, is wasted opportunity. We're a sport that, you know, you look at what's happening in Tonga at the moment, Lebanon, where whenever we seem to have a nation that takes to this game, and there are some natural affinities between the Poles and their physique and the sport of rugby league.
Yeah.
How much competition do they need? How regular do they need it? How important is a domestic competition to back up what you've started to do in the country? Do you need a calendar of games? Do you need to know that you're going to be in the qualifiers for the 2025 World Cup? What do we need to do right from the lessons that we've learned of doing it wrong?
There's two test matches taking place without me there, because I can't be there because of work. Not ideal for me, being the, if you like, the coach and performance director of Polish Rugby League at the minute, but...
You'll get a live stream.
It is what it is. I will be coaching them virtually through my website.
Yeah.
Which is rugbyleaguecoach.com.au, if you didn't know. But it is what it is, you know. I have had a meeting with Łukasz, the president, Krzysztof, the vice president, Wojciech, the captain, and Steve, who's on the Australian committee, last Friday, day before the game. We just basically just mapped out, had a chat, a casual chat about where we want to be. And basically, Łukasz said to me, Lee, we want you to be the coach for Emerging Nations 2021. What do you need in terms of... And he was keen to know what my boundaries were, what I wanted, blah, blah. I said, mate, give me 6 weeks, I'll put it all in writing for you. So that's where we're at. What's that going to look like? I think the next Emerging Nations World Cup, which is taking place in England, allegedly, will be, I think, any team that hasn't got the proper membership of the RLAF, I think they'll keep them out. I think that could be a mistake, because a game or two or three in the Emerging Nations could really kickstart a country. So
Absolutely. That's
a little bit of a plea there to maybe ignore that rule for some countries, because some countries will really struggle because of internal whatevers.
Well, they've
got
to get government recognition.
That's not easy
in some countries.
And, you know, I've sort of had a scheme in my head to allow them to have one tournament without that recognition and then... pending, you know. And I believe that what we need, the committee members need to look at that. And what I need is a few teams there coaching the Lee Addison way for a while.
Yep, yeah, that's important. To get continuity.
Get some continuity, yeah. The boys did a load of clinics last week, and I did one, long one. And we were in contact with something like 400 students of ages from 10 to 17. 50% male, 50% female.
That is interesting.
Don't be surprised if Poland comes on the women's rugby league scene just as fast as it does the men.
Well, there's... Turkey that was the big eye leading with that week. As well, aren't they?
There are
nations that you could play, not a million miles away.
So after I've done my little tour of Rugby League Heartland, I'm going to go home and I'll be sat on the plane for a long time, and I don't drink on planes. And I either read or I think or I sleep. And at some point I will get into my creative space and come up with that plan for Poland. I'm used to doing this, and there's certain ways I like to see it, and what I think is... Again, one of my big mentors in this regard was David Waite and the systems he put in place in England, you know.
Which still stand the test of time now.
Yes. And what people forget about England quite readily is that they'd never beaten the Australian schoolboys before until Waite's system started producing a couple of... And now, if you look at the last two decades, I suppose, or decade and a half, England regularly beat Australian schoolboys and vice versa.
I had the privilege of watching that series last year.
Yeah.
And England won the series easily.
Yeah.
With some guys who are now making their name in Super League.
That's right. So it will be something, it won't be a carte blanche copy, it will be a modified version of those kind of principles, basically. The first step we need is to get a lot of Polish players better at rugby league as soon as we can, you know, so that, and I think there's other things in there too that you can look at it from the other angle. We try and set up schemes where some of them can go and play in England for a bit or Australia and things like that.
Well,
you know?
Certainly, I think that was the case with Ukraine, who sent eight of their players over to play for Milford, who are one of the better organised community clubs over here. And again, it's just the experience of playing regular rugby league.
Yep.
It's not so much the standard you're playing at. It's getting to know the basics of the sport.
Yep, absolutely.
So I think there are openings for those sort of cross-cultural exchanges and that, and how important they are.
The key thing for me, there was a bit of a culture around the Emerging Nations World Cup team last year. They really formed a close bond. Honestly, if your daughter brought home any of these boys... there'd be one that is a bit rough around the edges, but you'd soon realise his heart is bigger than Leeds, you know. But all of them, the top quality humans, and a mate of mine from Ireland came to be my assistant around it as well, not an assistant coach, but an assistant around the camera and things like that. And Brian, and he just left and said, "Lee, these are real quality boys," you know. So there was a bit of a culture around that, and I feared we'd lost it a little bit with no games in the year, but we seem to have relit that fire. So yeah, I think, you know, onwards and upwards for Polish rugby league moving forward.
Excellent. It's a good news story.
Yeah, it is.
It needs
to
be backed.
It is.
And you won as well, which was
we won.
Which
and
is nice.
Let me tell you about the game. I mean, the Czech Republic, their collisions didn't ease off throughout the game. You know, I said to you that the game plan was sort of like go forward, and when they go backwards then move the ball sideways. I don't think they went backwards because we kept... They were very physical. They kept fighting in the game, not fighting with fists, fighting for points and metres. And then all the boys got together, had a good drink and a good feed afterwards. So there's one message I do want to get across. I mean, there's always the social media trolls who go on about, oh, too many Aussies and all this. I don't want to break their... We have these meetings regularly with the Poland team where they tell each other what Poland means to them. So on the Friday before the game, I asked all the Australian boys, and I'm a bit loath to call them Australian because of what I'm about to tell you, but I asked them to tell the Polish boys. And you should have seen what happened. There was tears, there was hugs, and we just sat on some sort of like park benches. We could have been sat outside your window here, mate, you know, just in the car, but we spoke... And without saying who it was, you know, there was one bloke whose grandparents' brother was shot in front of him in Poland when they were getting marched out. So they ended up in a camp and got the chance to escape, and they had a choice between Brazil and Australia, and they ended up in Australia. There's another man who, his granddad, when fleeing Poland to avoid Hitler, wanted to go to Canada, but they wanted people of a certain height, so you wouldn't have got in.
No.
But I might, because he just, and they sent him to Australia instead. There's another story of a grandfather and a grandmother who couldn't read proper English, and they assumed they were going to America. They said boat to America, ended up in Australia.
Yeah.
There's other players who were born in Poland and ended up just moving over to Australia because they wanted a better life, you know. So
You're reminding me of something that has always struck with me. I remember reporting on the 2000 World Cup where Lebanon were on that stage for the first time. And they did a press conference after a doubleheader in Wales.
Yeah.
And Hazim El Masri was put up, who obviously at the time was by far the most prominent player of heritage.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there were one or two Australian journalists in the room who wanted to decry this Lebanese team as just being a load of mercenary Aussies. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can't get in the Australian team. And he turned around and gave one of the best quotes I've ever heard and said, "My parents were forced to leave Beirut because of the war that was going on there.
Yeah.
Did you expect me to wait around until rugby league was invented?"
Yeah, that's good. I said to the players...
And it meant everything for him to
be playing
for Lebanon.
I said to the Polish boys last week, I said, don't necessarily listen to the Aussie boys' accents. Look at what's in their hearts.
Yeah.
And grown men were crying after the win. They had Australian accents.
As a sport, we have 800 people who are paid professionals.
Yeah.
We have to be a sport of heritage.
Yes. Oh, well, I think most sport is heritage too, really.
Well, there's a bit of backlash here at the moment because the Great Britain squad, initial training squad, has been announced. There's people like Blake Austin in it. And
Wayne Bennett's only doing what he's allowed to.
Absolutely. But, you know, if the players are committed and their background says they are eligible, why would we not?
I think the problem is when they switch countries.
Yeah.
So I always use the example of Tony Carroll. Played for Queensland.
Brent Webb.
Yeah. And then played for New Zealand. That doesn't make sense to me.
You should never be able to switch between two tier one nations.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole line, I mean, irrespective of what's happening in Tonga at the moment, the fact that some players are choosing, because of the strength of their heritage, to go from a tier one nation to a tier two nation, that's fantastic.
I wonder if they just scrap the tier in that sense and just say you can't switch. That might be something worth doing. And then... because I just think
we've got to have regular fixtures.
I just think it's a bit of a bad look sometimes when somebody like a Jared Hayne is seen in an Australian jersey and then a year later is seen in a Fiji. And the floating voter, the floating fan, it sort of brings the whole thing down a little bit.
I don't have a problem with that unless he goes back to Australia.
Mm.
But I also think there should be a recognition from nations like Australia that they don't necessarily have to pick players of heritage because they've got such a big player pool.
Yeah. It's a real tough one because New Zealand are obviously at a point where they might suffer at the minute.
Mm-hmm.
Although Tonga, the system over there seems to be doing its best to ruin its whole cut of chances.
There you go. That's rugby league.
We're sitting in front of... I'll switch it over to you now, mate. Not that we tend to follow too much of a protocol with our chats. Anyway, and one big thing I'm noticing the difference is I always feel like I'm shouting to you when I'm talking to you over Skype, and you probably feel like you're shouting to me. But now we sat next to each other, it's a bit more... there's a bit more decorum, Philip.
We're civilised.
Yeah. Your 40-20 magazine in front of me is open on the page about the British Lions. Discuss. What's going on?
Well, I suspect that we are going to get a tour. We are going to get the games that were scheduled to go ahead.
And that's about a month away, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're still thinking like that?
Only because of what's happening in Tonga. I mean, there's definitely going to be test matches against New Zealand. There's going to be tours for the men and the women to PNG, which is fantastic. The thorn in the side at the moment is, much as with Lebanon in the World Nines, who their top players are now saying they don't want to play for the governing body, the Tongans have got that issue by saying... the guys that are running the sport on the island are not delivering in their eyes for players that are making a huge commitment to play. As far as we can tell, the coaching change that has been instigated by the governing body back on the island has not met with the approval of the players who wanted to play for Christian Wolf and
not Frank Endicott. Yeah.
Well, initially not for Garth Brennan.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also an underlying issue with some monies that has been raised to put into the development of the game in the island, perhaps hasn't been spent.
That's right.
Yet.
Yeah.
So all of that needs addressing, and it's where you need a very strong international federation who, to be fair, have revoked the membership of Tonga to bring in, I think, a different governing body. So it's all going to happen.
I remember,
and it's great that the brand is back, because I think we need the British Lions as a marketing tool for the sport.
What's it going to do, though? Because I can't imagine that many people are going to fly over based on this kind of press coverage about what's going on.
There's not many press going, which is a worry in itself.
Mm.
But you have to restart somewhere. And I think bringing the brand back is valuable. It's what you do with that brand. You know, 2020, we're building up to a World Cup the following year. The Kangaroos are supposed to be coming over. Are they playing England? Are they playing Great Britain? Is Great Britain going to be once in every 4 years purely going on tour? All of that needs working out because we haven't got an international calendar.
Is there a funding issue around the Great Britain and England thing?
Yes, because Sport England will fund excellence under the banner of England.
England,
not under Great Britain.
Yeah.
So bringing back Great Britain, at some point it has to be a cash generator.
Yeah.
But also, I go back to the fact that it's the same with Poland in some respects. You need to know what your international fixtures are for the next 3 or 4 years. Leading up to the 2025 World Cup.
Don't get me started. Yeah.
But what's Great Britain? You know, we know where they're going in the autumn of 2019.
Yeah.
When are they playing again?
Yeah.
Are they playing in 2023?
Yeah.
In which case, that's fine.
People can start saving the pennies.
And players know that that's how it works.
Yeah.
But we don't. Sitting here today, we've got four games this autumn and nothing else.
And it's like we're stuck in a time warp too, because I remember, was it 1996? I was in France.
Mm-hmm.
Was I playing or was I coaching? I was playing. And I was hearing stories of 9 Great Britain players being sent home from a tour in New Zealand.
Cost-cutting measure.
Brian
McDermott was one of them.
Okay.
And he tells, again, a real heart-rending story about how much that affected him as a human being.
Yeah.
That the highest accolade you can get is being picked for your country. To be sent home because you're not in the final 17 of the last test match is just a despicable way to treat players.
Yeah.
He felt it even more because he'd been a serving soldier before he became a full-time professional rugby
player. All his life probably dreamed of pulling on that jersey too.
And he's never forgotten that. And one of the reasons he is such a revered person for the teams that he coaches is that he does create this bubble around the players, because it didn't happen when he was in the...
Yeah.
The international arena.
Yeah.
It was. I understand there is a cost implication to go on tour, but to make a decision like that is really poor.
And I remember hearing about that in France and just thinking my heart sunk, because it was only 2 years before that Great Britain had beaten Australia at Wembley 8-4, Jonathan Davis's try. A record crowd at Wembley outside of the World Cup final.
Yeah.
Which had only taken place 2 years before that.
And 2 years before that, in 1990, England had, or Great Britain had beaten Australia at Wembley.
Something like 1912, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And can you tell I was watching a lot of rugby league in those days? And I just thought that was almost the moment where good old rugby league that was picking up again really shot itself in the foot. So I remember around that time, Salford beat Wigan in the quarterfinals of the Challenge Cup or something.
Ended the 40-odd
game
winning run of Wigan.
I remember around that time, maybe 91-92, Castleford had beaten Wigan in the Regal Trophy final.
Thrashed them.
I remember Wigan had then also gone to Brisbane and won the World Club Challenge.
One of the greatest results ever in club rugby league.
So now we're talking about a period of time which was a... We'd die for that again. We'd die for those crowds. We'd die for that coverage. We'd die for those high-profile players.
But it came on the back of international rugby league being paramount.
Yes.
And one of the things we lost when the Super League war came in was that element of international competition. It was sidelined. And I'm not sure we've ever quite got that back. We sort of did with the 2013 World Cup here, but there was no legacy.
I do remember being, because I was on the staff of that 2013 World Cup with the Tomahawks, and I remember we watched a match, or tried to watch a match. The other two teams in our pool, Cook Islands and Scotland, or Cook Islands and Wales or something, just because if the result went a certain way, we finished top of the pool. And I remember us all being crammed into a room at the hotel. It was a high-quality hotel. And you honestly would have thought we were on some kind of Afghani US air base trying to get some kind of pictures of Armstrong on the moon. It was so crackly and horrible. And because they were trying to get it through the internet, which obviously wasn't quite as well developed as it is now. And that was 2013. And if we're wondering why there was no legacy, well, it's probably little things like that.
Added to the fact that...
Because so many other things were good. You know.
Well, we had 8,000 people in Bristol on a wet Wednesday night.
I remember it well.
Never went back there.
No.
I remember being at Rochdale on a Monday. Packed.
That 9,000. Was a Fiji game, wasn't it?
Yeah. But we never built on the back of that. So, it's legacy.
Yeah.
And I think that the 2021 World Cup recognises that.
Yeah.
I think it's good that we've got the Women's World Cup at the same time, the Wheelchair World Cup, and hopefully this Festival of World Cups preceding it. But it's what we do with it.
Yep, yep, yep.
And we're still talking about the great games of the 90s, and we've not recaptured those days yet.
Talking of the great days of the 90s and the Club Rugby League that was in there as well, a club like Wigan then was probably just coming to the end of its dominance. But its brand name probably lasted for another 10 years, really.
Until they left Central Park.
Roughly, yeah. I tapped into that when I was media manager at Wigan. You know, we're Wigan, this is how we do things, and blah, 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 blah. That might have lost some of its aura now. This weekend, I'm going to be heading to Wigan versus Salford semi-final. Rather than ring any of my old mates, I've decided to buy the ticket so I can go with my brother. £18, I think it is. Or because my stepdad's a season ticket holder, I think it goes down but from 23. So I think it's 23. He is a diehard, so he'll go to Salford if they play it on the other side of the world, you know. But our semi-final crowds haven't been great in the Super League.
Shocking.
And there's a problem in Australia too. Can you sort of hover around that and tell me what you're thinking?
Australia have had 3 sellouts.
Yeah.
And some
Canberra.
Of the... Yeah.
What were the other two?
Was there a... There was a Parramatta game at Bank West against Brisbane. Sold out.
I think being critically analytical, I think that's because Para fans are like the success-starved...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a new stadium.
And then what was the other one? Can you remember?
Was it not Manly. I can't.
Might have been Manly.
Might have been Manly.
Same with Manly. Des bringing the whole thing back to Manly. Manly's a pretty much a gated community. It's hard to get in and out of, and they're a bit... So I think there's mitigating circumstances around
that. But there is an appreciation within that competition that you're building up to something.
Yeah.
So if you've spent most of the year going and watching games... You'd be foolish to miss the most meaningful ones at the end of it.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got the exact reverse here. Clubs have spent so long generating a season ticket culture, wanting to have members over a very long season, and we've spoken about this a couple of times, that the season is far too long here.
Yeah.
The games at the end of the season become disproportionately expensive.
Yes.
So where you're saying that a ticket might be £23 if you decide to go and watch this week...
Yeah.
If you're a season ticket holder going and watching the regular season games, you're probably paying maybe 15 maximum.
Okay, yeah.
So if you've got potentially four games at the end of the season over a month, you're paying, relatively speaking, a lot of money.
Yes, yes.
And as a fan, we've now introduced things like the Magic Weekend.
Yeah.
A trip to Catalan.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're in the Championship, a trip to Toulouse, possibly even a trip to Toronto. The Challenge Cup final.
Mm-hmm.
That's all extra.
Mm-hmm.
You're then being asked, possibly, if you're a Salford fan, you've got 3 or 4 games that could take you to Old Trafford.
Mm.
That in total could cost £300 or £400.
Some
that's a lot of money.
Some fans will be saving
speaking.
Their money to get to Old Trafford.
Gamble, taking that risk.
There's also the weather thing, mate. I mean, my fellow English family and friends have been telling me that the weather has been on the change this week. I mean, we're looking out the window and it's persisted down constantly during this.
But that's what grand finals and playoff games are played in.
Do you think the weather affects some people's decision?
No, I think it's cost. I think we need to come up with something cleverer than the system we've got at the moment where everything is an add-on and extra.
We're on a road here. Street lane, is it?
It is.
I mean, you've probably been looking out this window for 20 years, mate. I mean, is there more cars at this time of day than there used to be? Because one thing I've noticed driving around is that the bloody road seems so packed.
We are gridlocked.
We are
absolutely gridlocked. But public transport isn't what it should be or needs to be what people...
I was thinking of going to Man City tonight with my dad, and we just weighed it up with both the driving out the ground and the public transport. We'd be lucky to get home at midnight.
And I think the other thing about that and maybe the playoff games is the fact that they are all live on telly.
And Rugby League isn't a bad TV product.
And if you do subscribe to Sky, again, that's another cost. And
it's,
so you might as well sit in the pub or sit at home watch the game than actually get in your car, get stuck on the M62, spend an extra £15 on a pie and a pint.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So all of that we need to weigh up. What do we want? The competition is devalued when you see the television pictures and there's nobody in the stadium.
Well, I know this week my stepdad has had to go to AJ Bell Stadium, which is a good 25 minutes drive from his house because the ground isn't actually technically in Salford, to get the tickets. I don't think he's been able to buy them online. I might be wrong.
Which, again, you've got to be conversant with the way people buy things these days.
Now, that could be my stepdad didn't know it was online, or it could be that it's not available. So, you know, I just want to put that disclaimer in there. Talking in and around logistics to go to the game, me, my brother, my best mate, my stepdad, we've swapped 1,000 WhatsApp messages this week about how we're going to do it. You know, it's not that simple.
No. And it needs to be.
Yeah. I do know their supporters' buses going from a certain pub. But, you know, catching up with my old mates and brother, I want to have a few pints before, you know.
Absolutely.
So, and these are all the things that matter. On the flip side, Toronto play Featherstone.
They do.
The story seems to be all about Featherstone, the media talk about the romance of Featherstone, the old... did they last win a Challenge Cup in the late 70s? Or
83.
Early, 83. But they play Toronto, and obviously if Toronto got into Super League, well, number one, would they be allowed into Super League? And two, I heard a little rumour this week that they've not been paying all their bills or something. What?
It's the old world against the new world.
Yep.
There is an interesting dynamic at play this week, because it's not just Toronto. Newcastle are playing in the League One Grand Final. They're away at Oldham.
Okay.
If they win, they're in the Championship.
Who finished higher in the ladder there?
Oldham did, but there wasn't a lot between them.
Yeah.
And it's possible that Newcastle could win that.
They've
recruited to get out of that division. We've got the romance of the Salford story against Wigan. The team that actually plays in the Old Trafford area could get to Old Trafford. Desperately... With the greatest respect to Wigan, the competition needs a new name at Old Trafford.
Do you think the RFL or Super League, deep down in their offices, do you think they would be worried about Salford getting the grand final for the crowd?
They would in terms of the attendance, yes, but there's a neutral buy-in. I know a lot of people that say if it's a St Helens-Wigan final, I'll watch it at home. I'm not bothered to go.
Yeah.
If Salford get there, a bit like Castleford in 2017, I've got a reason to go.
Yeah,
I've got somebody to support. Everybody loves an underdog.
Mm, mm, mm.
And then the third game is the one that you mentioned. That's Toronto and Featherstone. So the footprint of rugby league here could change this weekend.
Where's that getting played, Toronto and Featherstone?
Okay. Because they finished.
And what kind of crowds have they been getting for the semis?
9,000. They've been matching Super League at... And it's a new audience.
Mm.
So I think going back to your original question, Toronto will go up if they win. That will be ratified this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they haven't paid some bills, but name me a sporting club at the moment that pays every bill on time.
Mm.
They will need to lodge some kind of a bond. They will need to pay for teams to go out there. They will not take the distribution that they're entitled to. So there'll be financial restrictions on them, but I think they'll meet all of them.
Yeah, okay.
But I think more importantly for the sport, if Featherstone win, promotion is decided on the field.
Yeah. But
what Toronto could bring if they win is I think they will sign some players that will make the hair stand up on the back of your neck.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not messing around.
How well equipped will Featherstone be if they go?
They'll have to sign players who are being released by the likes of Hull KR, London.
Have they got any full-timers at the minute, Featherstone?
A few, but they've got some dual-registration players with Leeds, so they might turn into full-time.
Yeah.
The issue for me is not about the teams. The issue is the markets that those teams represent.
Mm.
So with the greatest respect to Featherstone, it's a mining village without a pit.
Mm.
Their average crowd at the moment is about 1,400, which as a percentage of the village is not bad.
Mm.
But is that as sustainable as
it's
a Super
village,
League
it's
business?
It's a village. Yeah.
Whereas Toronto is a worldwide city that brings a new market. Those 9,000 fans didn't know about rugby league 2 years ago, so what could it be if they were in the upper echelon playing the top teams? What would a Leeds or a Wigan or a St Helens take out there?
And is it true that the coach won't be at Featherstone next year?
Yes, he's leaving.
Where's he going?
Well, it was heavily rumoured he was going to Leeds, where he's been helping out part time and becoming a full time assistant. Mm. But I think his stock is that high that he could be going back to Australia.
Okay.
He was coaching in the Intrust.
That's right, Cup. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have raised an eyebrow and said he's done such a good job with Featherstone, we might want him back. Because there will be some coaching changes, presumably, in Australia at this time of year. So he'll have a choice. But I think it's more about what do we want the sport to look like over the next year. If Featherstone don't get promoted, they've been on a wonderful journey. Mm. And they'll be one of the favourites in the championship next year. If Toronto get promoted, whilst there is some resistance because they don't bring away fans and there is an element of the unknown, which nobody in rugby league likes. They don't like new empires being built if they're not in charge of it. There is a possibility for developing the North American market, and that the where the sport stands at the moment won't bring any more Sky subscribers, but the impression that it gives is much more appealing.
I would like to link sort of like my last question to basically what you were asking me about how Poland moves forward. If I was to look at Toronto and therefore by default Canada as a model, potential model, what have they done so well? Why has this been so successful? Because even if they lose on Sunday, it's still successful.
They've overspent.
Oh, okay.
No, but deliberately, not illegally overspent.
Yeah.
They have taken the view that it wasn't where they started in League One. It was where they wanted to be in Super League.
Okay.
So they've got an ownership group which is headed up by David Argyle, but there are other investors who have said, what will it take for us to get from where we start to where we want to be? How quickly can we do it? So they bought a championship team when they were in League One.
Mm-hmm.
They spent more on launching and marketing their kit and image than most teams in that division get as a handout.
Mm-hmm.
When they were in the championship, they bought a part Super League team.
Okay.
They fell at the final hurdle last year, and I think that was partly to do with they weren't mentally and physically prepared for that final game. I think they are this year, which is why I think they'll win it.
Yep.
They've also got a coach at the helm who knows how to win grand finals. And I think they've always geared up to be at the next level of development.
Yeah, fair enough.
And what we tend to do in rugby league, and it goes back a little bit perhaps to how do we develop Poland, how do we give dispensation to new nations? We allow them to grow by perhaps giving them an advantage. So it's like what you were saying about, of course we need domestic players, but what do the heritage players bring? Well, if they bring more than the sum of the parts, doesn't matter how many you have.
Well, there's not that many Canadians in that side and they're getting crowds of 9,000, so
and
they can't...
We need to get away from this idea that they don't have any Canadians. They don't play rugby league in Canada at the moment.
Not massively, anyway.
So all of the ice hockey teams that play over here, for example, which are quite well supported in places like Nottingham and Sheffield, they don't really have English players.
No.
They import American and Canadian
players. That's right.
So I think, again, you've got to have a plan,
yep,
which I think Toronto do in terms of putting rugby balls in kids' hands.
Yeah.
They need to work in concert with rugby union, which again is a new concept to us, because people over there don't get the idea that there are two forms of rugby.
Yeah.
I think the Canadian rugby union team are not going to do desperately well in the Rugby Union World Cup, but people might see what Toronto are doing and say, oh, it's rugby, it's an oval ball. I don't need to fully understand the nuances between the two teams, but I'm into rugby now.
Yeah.
Can I get my kid playing?
Rather than kicking it, I like them when they throw it around.
And I can go and have a really good time. In a, you know, maybe they need to look at moving stadia. I haven't been to Lamport yet, but I think it's almost at capacity. If they're in Super League, they might have to play somewhere else.
Yeah.
But the other exciting thing is geographically we're really restricted. The big success this year in terms of Super League has been taking a game to Barcelona.
Yes.
Which happened a bit by accident. It just so happened that Catalan Dragons won the Challenge Cup, went and paraded it at the football ground. The football ground said, would you like to come and play a game? They wanted Wigan. It just so happened that Wigan won the grand final. So you actually had a scenario where the champions were playing cup winners. Yep. We broke the crowd record. Got 33,000 in Barcelona. There's no plans to go back to Barcelona.
Yeah, okay.
But what Toronto have said is we need to take games on the road early in the season because the climate means we can't play in Toronto.
Yeah.
We might go and play another game in Barcelona.
Well, apparently Wodj, where I was last week, gets down to minus 22.
You ain't going to be playing a game outside when temperatures reach that.
And there's a grand final that I watched on YouTube the other day for a bit of context. And one player had a beanie on while he was playing.
There you go.
Mate, it'd be remiss of me, especially as I'm trashing you at the studio. We are in the coveted studio of the podcast. Tell everyone about your podcast and where they can find it and who's on it. And
you're only saying that because you're in a seat normally occupied by Gary Skelford. We've got four guys who get together every Monday night between 6 and 8 UK time.
Yep.
It's on YouTube, it's on Facebook, it's podcasted. I liken it to Last of the Summer Wine. It's four characters who are diametrically different, have respect for each other but question and won't allow anybody to get away with anything.
Yeah.
None of it is scripted. We don't plan in advance what we're going to talk about.
That sounds familiar.
We review the week's games. We preview the following week's games.
Yeah.
We talk about the issues in the sport.
Yeah.
We try and hold each other to account on, you know, Gary, who obviously is the guy who everybody's heard of. We've got 46 Great Britain caps between the four of us. He's got them all.
But who were the other two with you?
Mark Wilson, who is a commentator on National Radio and has just been doing some work for Sky as well.
Yeah.
And Richard Shaw Wright, who's the technical wizard.
Yeah.
But we're all very different. We all like to take the mickey out of each other.
Good.
And I think Gary is a guy who sees everything black and white.
Yeah.
I just need to remind him that what he thought was black last week, he's now saying is white this week. I tend to see shades of grey. So we're all very different. Mark is a really good agent provocateur. He can start a debate as well as have opinion about it. And Richard is really acerbic. Doesn't say a lot, but when he does, it's worth listening to.
And
it sort of works.
So what do people need to type into YouTube or Google?
It's 4020 Live.
40 letters or word numbers?
It's the name. It's the word 40, the number 20.
The 40, 20. Yeah.
Live.
Yep.
You'll find us. We do other stuff at grounds. You know, we're at a game, we'll do YouTube stuff and Facebook stuff.
Yep.
I don't really understand why it works, but people seem to like it.
That's good. Well, our next chat, I'm afraid, is going to be 12,000 miles.
It's just been good to see you.
And you mate.
Haven't changed.
You neither. Take care. Speak soon.
Look forward to it. Safe journey.
Hope you enjoyed that. Myself and Phil can talk forever. We actually did before we recorded that podcast, and we did after I recorded that podcast. I was there with him for about 4 hours in his bookshop there, which is Philip Howard Bookstores near Round A in Leeds, if you could get the chance to go in. If you don't get the chance to go in and you want to help or have a look at some of the books that are there, just give me a message through admin@rugbyleaguecoach.com.au. Twitter @RLCoach on the net, or Facebook and Instagram @RugbyLeagueCoach, or go on the website rugbyleaguecoach.com.au and I can get the message to Phil for you and see if he can get you a book that you're interested in or see if he stocks it. please have a look at that website, rugbyleaguecoach.com.au. That's why we exist. Keep doing the hard work and the hard yards that you're doing. You're doing a great job. Take care, and until next time, where we'll probably do our third Kaplan and the Coach, or Coach and Kaplan, whatever you want to call it. Take care.